Over a cloud of illuminated space dust, the words Accelerator Media appear in metallic block letters. Strips of film crisscross over the letters BP, Ben Arroyo Pictures. White lines on black slide into place. The FYZZ facility. A film strip runs vertically as through a flickering projector, International Film Trust. On a black background, the white silhouette of a hummingbird flits across the screen, then hovers, with fairy dust falling from its wings to form the words, Construction Film. A Skellig Rock and Construction Film Production. A Ben Arroyo Pictures production. In association with Kanana Films, International Film Trust, and the FYZZ facility. In co-production with ZDF and Labette Lumineuse, Art France Cinema. With the participation of Art France and with support from FFF Bayern, present a Werner Herzog film. Title, Salt and Fire. A vehicle drives slowly down a narrow road lined by stone walls. In the rearview mirror, the driver is seen wearing a black ski mask. Only his eyes are visible. The vehicle approaches a metal gate. Two guards with rifles step out front. They are also wearing ski masks. They open the gate, and the vehicle proceeds through to a courtyard. Two more masked men approach from an inner gate. When the car stops, another masked man motions the others to follow, then leads them through to an inner courtyard. A woman with a blindfold tied over her eyes is taken from the car and pulled forward by an armed guard on each side. Her hands are cuffed in front of her. A masked man in a motorized wheelchair rolls out in front of them. He stops at the arched doorway to a stucco-sided building, and the others move past him through the door. His eyes follow them. Inside the building, the woman is shown seated in a chair, her head bowed forward. Her blonde hair straggles out around the blindfold. She is trembling. Masked men with guns are in the shadows, including the man in the wheelchair. Beside her, one of the men stirs a cup and presses it into her hands.
Please, you must drink some tea. Here, take it off.
The wheelchair moves forward.
Could you move your head forward, please? A little? There we go.
He pulls her blindfold up. She blinks at the light, scowling at him.
Nice meeting you again.
Her eyes dart around the room at the armed guards. She takes a breath.
I demand to be set free, now. Now!
Please drink.
No, thank you.
It may taste strange, even bitter, but it will help you adapt to the altitude.
I do not care.
The tea is brewed from coca leaves, that is it.
I want my handcuffs removed.
You have scratched one of my men and bitten another.
I am proud of that.
Well, that is why you are wearing handcuffs! Can I take them off now? Look at me! Look at me! Can I take them off now?
Yes, you can!
The leader flicks his finger, and the man in the wheelchair rolls around to her other side.
Please put the cup down. Put the cup down. Your hands.
Her arms are stretched toward him, and he lifts them awkwardly. The metal handcuffs glint in the sunlight.
Ah! Ah!
She does not look at him as he releases her. She rubs one wrist.
Is that better?
I demand an explanation.
Everything will fall into place.
When will I get my passport back?
I'm not sure.
When will I be able to leave?
Of that, too, I am unsure.
She slumps in her chair.
I'm hungry. I haven't eaten since I was on the plane.
30 hours ago.
The view slides toward the window and fades away, transitioning to the dimly lit first-class section of a flight in process. A flight attendant guides a cart with linens and fine barware down the aisle, stopping at the woman's seat. She has hardly touched her food.
Thank you. Here, please take the tablecloth.
Thanks. Would you like me to get you something else?
No, I get terribly jet-lagged when I eat too much on overnight flights.
All right.
Just leave me the apple juice, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Her seatmate motions to the attendant.
Sweetheart, can I have another glass of champagne, please?
Your fourth.
I like that you keep count on what's good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And another glass for my most attractive companion, Professor Sommerfeld. L-A-U-R-A. Sommerfeld. Merci.
He squeezes the professor's knee as he reaches for the champagne and sips.
Let's celebrate.
She lifts his hand away, rolling her eyes.
Celebrate what?
Can we get another glass for Dr. Meyer, who's right there across the aisle? We're all in the same journey together. We need to warm up for the journey ahead.
Make mine a double bourbon. Straight, no ice.
She goes back to the diagrams on her tablet device.
And what, if I may ask, is your joyful party all about?
We are a scientific delegation.
She's Professor Laura Sommerfeld, our fearless leader. We come with the United Nations.
To look into an ecological disaster. The Diablo Blanco disaster.
Diablo Blanco? I haven't heard of that.
Diablo Blanco will soon be a household name.
The flight attendant gives a vague smile and backs the cart away down the aisle. Laura continues to go through slides on her tablet. The images show topographic maps with red zones and integrated charts. Beside her, her traveling companion closes his eyes, champagne glass in hand. Later, the cabin lights have been turned down and the passengers are asleep in their seats. Laura is reclined, her head tilted to the side, her eyes closed. Her seatmate is curled on his side under a blanket, and he seems to be asleep, but his hand inches out from under the cover and cups Laura's breast. Her eyes open, and she elbows his hand away.
Dr. Cavani.
Fabio? You can call me Fabio.
She gets up and finds the flight attendant sitting in the gallery at the back of the first class section.
Sorry. Is there any way I could change seats?
I'm so sorry, the plane is completely full. I'm so sorry, I can't.
She returns to her row to find that while Fabio is still sleeping by the window, Dr. Meyer has moved into her seat, leaving his own seat across the aisle open. His eyes are closed. She settles into the empty space and shuts her eyes.
Professor Sommerfeld, sleep well.
Call me Laura.
In the arrivals area at their destination, many people wait in a long line to go through customs. Laura adjusts her watch.
What's the local time?
I don't know.
Let me do it for you.
Thank you. What's our guide's name?
Helmholtz. He's from the Ministry of Agriculture and the Environment. And he's coming with two people,
Squinting at his notes.
I can't seem to read this. It's my own handwriting. I don't even understand it. I'm sorry.
He checks his mobile phone.
No signal.
Mine's dead too.
We will ask them to provide us with local phones.
You know, but my apps can become very useful.
Such as?
My diary. April 14th, arrivals hall, immigration line. The line is lethargic. It's listless, torpid, moribund. I think I put that quite well, didn't I? Right? And we're waiting and staring, people staring at us as if they were competing for the world championship of slow looks.
Dr. Maya, why are they staring at us when I stare back at them? They don't look away.
A group of three men dressed in black are openly staring at the delegation from the other side of the barricade. The view switches to Laura and her traveling companions looking back. They seem quite disconcerted. Later, the scientists wait near the luggage conveyor belt while a police dog sniffs at bags gliding past. Other travelers grab their suitcases and depart. Laura, Fabio, and Dr. Meyer peer over the conveyor belt to watch for their own bags. After a while, there are no more bags coming out of the cargo area. The conveyor belt comes to a halt. The dog and its handler hop over it and head out. Dr. Meyer peeks past the curtain into the cargo area but sees nothing. Almost everyone has left the arrival zone. The last travelers are wheeling their bags through the exit doors.
Where's my luggage?
Mine is not coming out either. Oh, fuck, I forgot to pack my toothbrush. I didn't bring a toothbrush with me.
Looking around, they walk past the airport attendant, and Fabio speaks to her in Spanish before they too head out the doors with only their carry-on bags.
Just a little. Am I not? No? Why? Gracias.
Let's just go.
Yeah. Happens.
They exit the international arrivals area into a general waiting zone that is entirely deserted. A car stand and a lost luggage office are locked up. No one is waiting for them at all. The little group stands uncertainly in the empty lobby space, looking around in confusion.
Well, I'm sure they'll come any minute now.
Sure thing. Oh, yeah.
Where are they? You confront our arrival plans, Cavani, right?
Righto, yeah. I did.
Should I check at the curb?
No. Let's stick together. Someone will show up sooner or later.
They wander through the empty space, and Dr. Meyer raps on the glass of an office. Men are seen approaching the airport from the parking lot. One is in a wheelchair. The glass doors part.
Hello, I'm sorry I'm late. It's me, welcome. Oh, Professor Sommerfeld, welcome
hello.
To you. Dr. Cavani,
yes.
Welcome. You must be Dr. Meyer, welcome to you too, sir, welcome. Did you have a good flight?
Yeah, good, we are just a little bit jet-lagged.
Of course, I can understand. Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't introduced myself. I'm Aristides from the Ministry.
Aristides?
Yes, Aristides. Now, the minister and his group apologize. There's been a change of plans. The minister is already in Aurora, and he asks that you take his plane directly there.
Giving her an official-looking letter.
Forgive us, kind gentlemen,
but we are forced to meet you in Aurora later today.
The letterhead says internal security. Isn't our liaison the Ministry of Agriculture and the Environment?
Oh, there's been a mistake. This shouldn't be here.
A mistake?
Yes, it's a mistake. I wasn't supposed to let you know, but I'm obliged to now. The minister is, in fact, also associated with the security establishment. It shows its increasing importance within the government.
But we don't have our luggage yet.
Oh, don't worry about that. Don't worry about anything. My boys will take care of everything. In fact, they'll see you through security. No inspections, no passports. I just need your luggage tags, and we'll have your luggage taken directly to the plane.
Great. Sounds like a treat.
Okay. Let's go.
They head to the waiting airplane in a van with Aristides. He rides in his wheelchair. Several armed guards also ride with him. Several planes of various sizes are parked on the tarmac, but nothing is moving. The van stops beside a twin-engine prop plane. Everyone gets out. Aristides is the last to get out of the van, rolling down a ramp in his wheelchair. The others stand by the plane.
I'm afraid I'll have to leave you here.
And our luggage?
It's already loaded.
How did you load it so quickly?
This isn't a German airport in New York. We're much more efficient.
It's just my instruments. I don't care about my shirts, but my equipment.
Let us worry about all that. Bon voyage.
Please come aboard.
They board, walking up the steps past a big guard with unruly black hair. Other armed guards stand watch. Aristides waves as they go. Once in the air, the scientists look out the windows of the small plane, while three of the guards sit in a row at the back of the cabin. Laura looks at them a few times, but Dr. Meyer and Fabio seem to pay them no attention. Dr. Meyer gives her a cookie.
My apologies. I ate half.
Thank you.
For one too much, for all too little.
Sounds familiar. Who said that?
Alexander the Great. One day, his army was perishing from thirst, and a foot soldier came by with a helmet filled with water. He had collected drop by drop for weeks. He gave it to Alexander and spilled it on the floor. And he said that. He said, for one too much, for all too little.
It's not going to be easy out there.
As long as I have my equipment, everything will be fine.
As long as we have some pasta al dente and some white truffles and a buxom wench serving wine and some vineyards in the mountains and the lusty cheers of the vintners.
Cavani, you are a poet.
Everything will be fine.
The plane is descending to land on an airstrip in a remote area. The topography looks like foothills covered in scrub grasses. There is no city or settlement nearby, only a building at the edge of the airstrip. More armed guards await the plane. The big guard with black hair is the first one off.
Please come out.
What is this? Who are these men? I'm not going to get out here. Where is the minister?
Please step out.
As he backs down the steps, the other guards are seen to be wearing black ski masks. Their faces are completely hidden. Laura and the other scientists cautiously exit the plane, looking at one another with worried expressions. Looking out at the airplane from the building, the guards are seen ushering the group inside, out of the sun. The scientists look quite travel-weary by now. The lead guard gestures them into the space, and it seems to be a small airport with a luggage conveyor belt and a few chairs. The luggage belt is stopped, and it is empty. The scientists look at it in confusion, then they notice the lead guard pulling on a ski mask.
Hey! No.
What is this?
You are under our protection. We have a security program.
Who are you?
I know who I am.
Who sent you?
I'm not gonna tell you.
I am Professor Sommerfeld and leader of this delegation. We are under the protection of the government.
Yes. And?
And we are under the protection of the United Nations.
I know. Come outside, please.
Hey.
We have cars waiting for you.
And our luggage. Please, don't touch
not going. Stay here. I am not going with you. Don't touch me.
You are my prisoners. All of you are my prisoners.
Dr. Meyer, a small man, headbutts the guard in the stomach, then hits him with his briefcase in the crotch. Laura rounds on the gunman with her bag, but other guards overpower them both. Fabio scurries into the bathroom, chased by guards. He hides in a toilet stall for a moment before coming out with his hands up.
Vamos,
Dr. Meyer, don't fight. They'll hurt you. Stop fighting back. We give up. Stop.
A guard points a gun in her face, and another yanks a blindfold tight over her eyes. Someone else secures metal handcuffs roughly around her wrists. Her hands are up. The guards are doing the same with Dr. Meyer and Fabio. As they exit the airport, it is revealed to be bigger than it seemed, and it is completely deserted. A highway runs past, and some of the guards train their guns on cars going by, while other guards load the handcuffed scientists into waiting vehicles. Dr. Meyer runs at Laura's car, his blindfold pushed up, still handcuffed. He slaps his blood-covered hands against the windshield, leaving streaks of red.
Get him away!
No!
Come on! No. Get me, motherfucker, away!
The driver of Laura's SUV pulls out, and the other vehicle follows. Storm clouds are rolling in over the rocky foothills that surround the airport, darkening the sky. As the view rises to look down on the departing cars, the entire parking lot is seen to be completely empty. The vehicles drive through the countryside. Rain hits the windshield, and the wipers scrape the water away. Laura rocks back and forth with the motion of the car, still wearing her blindfold. She is unable to see when the weather changes, or the little town that they approach with walls of stacked fieldstone along the road. They drive down into a valley, and the plant life gets more green and lush than the desert scrub higher up. The sunlight breaks through. Laura seems to sense this and tilts her head up, but the guard behind her shoves her head back down, pulling her hair.
Don't touch me!
Out the window, the scenery is raw and beautiful, with rough mountains softened by a thick carpet of green leaves. The driver approaches the iron gates of the compound, and the timeline has come full circle to the present. Once again, the masked man in charge steps out in front of the car and leads the guards with Laura through an inner courtyard to the stucco building. Along the way, the masked man in the wheelchair, now known to be Aristides, rolls out in front of them. Drinking tea.
So, this was all a plan from the beginning?
In a way, yes.
Why have you abducted us? What's your plan now?
Everything will fall into place. It depends on you.
There is no question that our embassy has been alerted to our disappearance.
They are already in crisis mode, but it is irrelevant because there will be no negotiations.
And the delegation was supposed to meet us upon arrival. Have you taken them too?
No, they were easily bribed. I take no pride in this.
I don't approve of payoffs to anyone.
Do me one favor. Do not try to come to the rescue of a tired world.
I'd like to know your name.
As long as I wear this mask, I have no name.
But I know the face of this gentleman.
Krauss, why don't you remove your mask? You are compromised, aren't you?
Krauss? You said your name was Aristides.
In fact, if facts count here, it isn't Aristides.
So it is Krauss?
Yes and no.
And how were you able to get here so quickly?
We have our ways.
And who is we, I would like to know.
We? That is basically me.
I am the brain.
I'm leading a delegation. I'm responsible for its members. Where are they? Are they all right?
I can assure you they are fine.
I accept no assurances from an unidentified man with no name and no face. I want to see them now.
Well, hopefully, the time will come when there are no more secrets between us. Dr. Arnold Meyer and Dr. Fabio Camani are both here at the compound.
How is Dr. Meyer? I saw him and heard him.
He is bruised, but otherwise subdued.
Meaning what?
As Dr. Meyer proved to be so combative, we had to calm his heroism a little bit.
Krauss, why don't you show Professor Sommerfeld the food she should avoid? Go on, have a look.
He gets a meat pie.
Please, do not eat these, even if offered with every indication of warm hospitality.
You gave this to my delegation?
We did nothing. Our guests ate it. And then they came down with a local form of...
What's happened to them?
Say it.
Diarrhea.
Krauss, why don't you show our guest to her quarters?
The masked leader stalks out. Krauss wheels in the other direction. Laura follows, glancing around the room. It is richly decorated with art and tapestries. Crystal chandeliers sparkle. The opulence is in stark contrast to the atmosphere of menace created by the armed guards. In the courtyard.
Life in a wheelchair has its comforts, but not all the time.
I see.
It's okay. One day I shall walk again. Dr. Meyer, Dr. Cavani, please come to the window.
At the barred window, they look pale and sick.
I'm dying.
No, you're not.
I'm dying.
No, you're not.
I'm dying.
No, you're not.
The dumplings. It must have been the dumplings.
Are you hurt?
Yes, but I'm going to be fine. It's just my stomach. I've got the dressing of diarrhea.
It's a horde of protozoans swirling around my intestinal tract. I may be dying.
The noblest place for a man to die is the place he dies the deadest.
This is a mother of all diarrhea.
Take care. Keep yourself hydrated and get some rest.
Professor Sommerfeld, I wish I could help you. No.
Subtitles. Talk to them and listen to them. Let them talk and never let the conversation stop. That's the best in a hostage situation. I've read that once. Listen to them. Let them talk.
Please abstain from gossiping in that ugly language.
I'm fine. I can take care of myself, of my situation, of our situation. Let me try.
Madam, please follow me. Your quarters are in the adjacent courtyard.
They head through an arched doorway.
This way.
Fabio staggers away from the window. Dr. Meyer looks out, his expression morose. In the next courtyard, a guard unlocks a door, sends Laura through, and then locks it again behind her. On the other side, she finds another bolt lock to secure the door from the inside. She slides it into place, trying the door. She turns to the rest of the room. It is sparsely furnished, but comfortable enough with a bed and dresser. Her bag is on the dresser. She goes through it quickly, taking stock of her wallet, binoculars, and tablet device. She crosses to a window and opens the interior shutters. Several armed guards look back at her. She shrinks against a wall, out of their line of sight. Crossing to another window, she opens it. Seeing no one in front, she pulls open the hinged panes so that she can touch the metal bars. She gives them a shake, leaning down to test them at the base. On the other side of the bars, a guard steps right out in front of her, his gun at her eye level. She pulls away around the corner of the wall, ducking into the washroom. It is white and clean, if rustic. The sight of her own reflection stops her. She runs a hand over her cheek. Now, sitting on the bed, she lifts up her tablet and focuses it to take her own photograph. Her hair is straggling down around her face, and she looks like she has been crying.
Laura, you look a mess.
She sets the tablet aside and breaks down. The screen goes dark. The next day, Krauss wheels into a dining room. Laura is seated at a table with the leader, who is still masked.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Giving them breakfast rolls.
Rest assured, this food is safe to eat.
Thank you, Kraus.
Kraus wheels out. The leader cuts a serving in half, putting a plate in front of Laura.
Half for you, half for me. You choose.
She eyes the food, then takes the plate.
Excuse me for taking your share, but I'm hungry. And I'm sure you didn't abduct me to poison me.
Not at all. I'm glad to see you eating.
She attacks the food ravenously. He sips some juice.
I would like to see Dr. Meyer and Dr. Cavani.
Be assured, they are my respected guests.
Why are you holding me hostage? Is it for money? We can contact some officials to negotiate.
No.
Tell me what you want. You must be Secret Service. Are you enjoying the massive support of the government?
I am no Secret Service, no government, no plot of the CIA or anything of the sort.
Who are you then?
He takes his mask off.
Professor, I expected more of you. Matt Riley.
The CEO of the consortium.
The consortium exists only as a legal entity today. As you may know, after the ever-opportunistic Swiss sold their majority stock, the Chinese, the Americans, the South Koreans all ducked into the trenches and became invisible. But they're still there.
They're all responsible for the Diablo Blanco disaster.
Despite that the disaster had already begun when I took over as CEO, I personally feel responsible.
But you must have known. It was not a singular event. It has evolved over decades. We have measurements, data, and statistics since the 70s.
Data. Statistics. I see another side to it.
Public relations.
Don't belittle yourself. I'm not prepared to speak about it now.
Because you are trying to hide a big conspiracy, Mr. Riley.
I find that silly. There is no reality. There are only views of reality, only perceptions. All collective anxieties condense into conspiracy theories.
My data is real. There is a disaster.
Yes, and there are 3 million Americans who claim they have had encounters with aliens. Among them, 300,000 women who claim that they have been abducted and gang raped by aliens. Now, this leads me to two questions. One, why do all these women weigh over 350 pounds? And two, why have we never heard of a single abducted woman in Ethiopia?
She looks confused.
Of course, the Diablo Blanco disaster exists. And it is not static. It is spreading.
And my delegation has been sent to determine at what rate and make our findings public. What prevents me from doing so is that you have taken me prisoner.
He stands.
I am prepared to accept the consequences, even go to prison for what I am doing.
I demand to be released.
Don't pressure me. This could end very badly for both of us. Do you want to be a martyr?
He storms out. She sits very still. Alone in her room, Laura sits by the window. She gets up and stretches her arms and shoulders. She does push-ups against the edge of the dresser. Then she is seen in a V position, her back raised off the floor, extending her arms and legs to work her core. She still wears the same traveling clothes, including her work boots. She flops back on the rag mat, arms overhead. Activating the tablet video.
I'm Laura Sommerfeld. I've been abducted. I've been in a car. At least 2 or 3 hours. I do not know where I am, but I will play their game to figure out what Riley wants.
Kroos leads her back to the main house. A guard stands by. She goes inside and finds Riley looking at a green parrot in a cage.
Hola, remember now, thy greater, in the name of Violet.
This magnificent specimen, Mr. McMurphy, speaks.
What did it just say?
Remember now thy creator in the days of thy youth. You know what Nostradamus said about talking birds?
No, I do not read Nostradamus.
He foretold what sounds like science fiction today. He said, household pets finally communicate with man. Life then possible outside the planet. A new tyrant sows terror events to come.
A world run by big data and predictive analytics doesn't care about Renaissance predictions. I want to know how Maya and Cavani are.
It's not so much the predictions themselves that fascinate me. It's where they come from. Are they true? Is it possible that there is something all-pervading around us which we are incapable of seeing, that your data can't analyze, which only the prophets and birds can express? He has a habit of saying it at the oddest moments. Remember now thy creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I had no pleasure in them. Ecclesiastes.
He turns, leaving her standing in the window by the bird for a moment before she follows him. They stroll in the courtyard with Kraus in his chair.
You have done research at the Institute for Developmental Biology in Tübingen?
I worked with mother organisms such as the zebrafish, fruit flies, and a form of cress from the cabbage family.
Interesting.
It has been shown that genes which influence development work in a similar way in different organisms, be they flies or people or cress.
And you are currently doing research at the Max Planck Institute of Biochemistry in Munich.
Technically, yes.
But here you are thrown back into biochemistry.
Sometimes you do step back in your life.
You don't seem pleased by this.
Well,
your life, as I have observed it, seems to be a happy one for you. There's someone's future to care for.
What do you know about my life?
Are you not blessed with a beautiful daughter, 8 years old?
She takes a deep breath, looking immediately suspicious. He reaches out to touch her hand. She pulls away.
I'm sorry. What a clumsy fool I am.
I find your treatment of my colleagues and me clumsy.
Accepted, but for that I shall not apologize. I've given up part of myself, but not that.
How are Maya and Cavani?
Her eyes widen.
If you have harmed Maya or Cavani, you will be tried before an international tribunal, and you will suffer severe punishment.
She stands. Kraus gets up, takes a few steps, and waves his gun at her.
Can we finally talk business? Mr. Kraus, do I see you walking?
Yes, you do.
Is this a miracle?
No, I only use a wheelchair when I'm tired of life. This is not the way we should do it. I propose we finish it now. The moment of truth.
Not the entire truth. That moment is to ever come and will depend on Professor Sommerfeld and on time.
How much time?
He leans in next to her ear.
Truth is the only daughter of time.
She stays very still while he rises. Kraus can be seen standing between them, holding his gun across his chest. Riley reaches into her hair, pulling something from the strands at the front and pinching it in his fingers.
I somehow feel a threat out there. I'm glad I have the distraction of my data.
She sits on the bed in her room, going through the charts, tables, maps, and other analytics on her tablet. The changing light from the screen is reflected on her face. She looks worn out.
There is something strange and potentially dangerous about Riley. I need to keep him talking.
She gets up close to the interior shutters on the window. The room gets dark. Later, she is with Riley in a room lined with old books and other documents. He pulls a book off a shelf, turning to her.
We have a lot of documentation on the court proceedings against animals. Oh, yes, see? A sow was sentenced to death for killing and eating a toddler. The pig was burnt at the stake.
And here, the salamander?
Oh, yeah. The salamander was believed to originate from fire, being a companion of the devil. See, here it says, this salamander was exorcised with a bucket of holy water, then burned.
Looking away from the drawing on the page.
I think I was meant to live a different life.
Another room in the library, just as full as the first. Some metal cylinders sit on a table.
Look in this silver column.
Each column sits on a distorted painting, but reflected in the metal, the art makes sense. A portrait.
I see, it's anamorphic art.
Yes. And this is the descent from the cross. You see, this is what your situation must look like to you, unclear, contorted. But if you move one step further, everything falls into place. Everything makes sense. At least that's what I think. It's a question of which angle you choose to look from.
That sounds like a banality, like...
Like what? I'm open to criticism.
Well, I don't want to sound insulting, but it sounds like a shallow pseudo-argument, like all Africans have rhythm in their blood.
I bow to you. May I be more precise about different angles, perspectives?
Yes.
Yeah.
He takes a thick book from a shelf.
All my life, I've wanted to see this in person.
He opens the book to a black and white photograph and points at it.
Where is this cloister?
In Rome, in the convent of the Santissima Trinita. Now just look along this corridor. Completely normal. A saint sitting under a tree. But the nearer one approaches, the more incomprehensible the forms become. Until, look at this. The folds in the saint's cowl become this vast, stretched out landscape. The folds, in fact, elongated like this, become the Strait of Messina, which the saint wanted to cross, but the boatman would not take him. So he threw his coat onto the water and surfed to Sicily. Just imagine yourself walking along this cloister. I have always dreamed of this.
The image of the library fades and becomes the corridor in the cloister, dreamy and sepia-toned, with windows on the right and the painted mural of the tree and priest on the left. As the image progresses down the corridor, the mural starts to change, elongating and distorting, until, at a certain point, it clearly becomes a river, and a small figure stands on shore waiting for a boat on the water. Now, they are back in the main house. Guards stand outside.
You know, the truth is, I don't really want to be CEO of the consortium anymore. Or anything else for that matter. That's why I live here. It's a different life. I'm trying to bring who I really am into focus. You see?
They pass through another library room as luxurious as the other spaces, and then into a bedroom housing an ornately carved four-poster bed and a clawfoot wooden chest. The wood has been polished until it glows.
I would have offered you these quarters for your comfort, but I couldn't.
Why is that?
Well, 100 years ago, the president of the republic died in this bed. And it has to be kept this way for all time. There are so many ancient things here.
May I be straightforward?
He gives a small nod and meets her gaze.
What do you want from me?
I kind of like you.
Me as a person?
No.
As a woman?
I find you very attractive, but there's something beyond that.
She hardly moves as she looks at him. Her eyes narrow, almost imperceptibly. He makes a fire in a fireplace, and they sit near the warmth.
I know I act as if I know everything, but allow me to ask about your daughter again. My apologies. If you do not wish to speak, I fully understand.
I only took this assignment because of my daughter.
In what sense?
I had to divert my thoughts. I had to be occupied by something. I had to have a job far out in the field.
This makes me curious.
She struggles to respond.
My daughter has not been with me for 4 years now.
Where is she?
She's in Morocco.
Morocco?
Yeah. She's with her biological father.
But I know that you've never been married.
Her father took her back to his country. And he refuses to return her. I've sued ever since, but the Moroccan legal system is very slow.
I'm sorry to hear that. Having children invites tragedy.
You have children?
He nods, slowly, looking at the fire.
Are you afraid of something?
Do I look like it?
No, I apologize.
I used to be afraid as a little boy.
Children who aren't afraid scare me. A little boy who isn't afraid would cease to be a boy.
I used to be afraid of the dark. But my grandmother told me something that stuck with me ever since. She said, it's okay to be afraid of the dark, but the real tragedy in life is when men are afraid of the light.
She takes that in. The light outside is fading and the room grows dim. The fire crackles and they both turn their faces toward it. Later, she sleeps on the coverlet in her room, still wearing her clothes and boots. She wakes and looks around. The room is dark except for a single bedside light. She presses her thumb and fingertips into the dust around the edge of the light, leaving her mark. In pencil, she writes on the inside of a cupboard. The message says, Laura Summerfield, we cover the Diablo Blanco disaster. Then, Krause comes to the door.
Get your bag.
Where are we going?
Get it now.
He walks her to a waiting car. Riley is there. Armed guards stand by, as always.
I demand to know where we are going.
Get in the car.
No. I'm not leaving without my colleagues. Where are they?
Please do not embarrass me.
Tell me what's happened to Dr. Meyer and Dr. Cavani.
They are safe.
And me?
You are not.
He shoves her into the middle seat. Krauss gets in the front. Riley gets in beside Laura. Two masked men are in the back.
I am your prisoner, but as such, I would like to...
As much as you, I am prisoner myself of my plans. There's no way back now.
They are leaving the compound and drive past more guards. A bird's-eye view centers on two vehicles traveling on a narrow paved road that cuts through the wild countryside. Low mountains are outlined against the horizon. The vegetation turns from green cover to desert scrub, and the sun blazes down on the travelers. They come to an abandoned village split by railway tracks running in a hard line over the cracked dry earth. The vehicles arrive at something like a train graveyard with rusted out steam engines and lines of cars left to disintegrate in the elements. They stretch out as far as the eye can see. Walking by the old trains.
Where are we?
Only a short distance from the very place you traveled 10,000 miles to see.
Lake Diablo Blanco.
Mm-hmm. Although these trains were abandoned here 100 years ago, time has propelled them somewhere, maybe even into the future.
Is there such a thing as science fiction that looks back in time instead of ahead?
Certainly. See, these trains, they never had a purpose. They had nothing to transport, nowhere to go.
Aliens must have left them here.
Sure thing.
Can I take a picture?
Yeah, as long as you keep my men out of the frame.
Please do it quickly. We have to move on.
But the railroads...
They're senseless. They only allow us to go from where we already are to where we're no better off.
Turning, Laura holds up her tablet and frames up a line of rusted train cars. It stretches back over the desert until it meets the horizon. They drive on until they come to a vast expanse of flat white ground, blinding in the desert sun. They stop and get out.
This is Uturunku. I thought it was important you see it.
Uturunku, the dormant volcano.
I know what your field of study is, Professor, but there is something much bigger looming than the Diablo Blanco disaster. The entire area of Uturunku, thousands of square miles, is lifting. And the volcano itself is rising and expanding all at a rate that exceeds any previous measurements. In fact, it is rising so rapidly that we are experiencing permanent round-the-clock tremors.
And what could happen?
We should ask how fast it could happen. It might happen in 200,000 years, maybe in 20,000. Or maybe in 20. There's no point in asking about nearby population. When Uturunku erupts, our entire planet will be obscured for decades. It won't matter if you live in the Arctic or the Himalayas or Australia. We will disappear as a species.
I am more concerned about what we have created here and now. A gigantic salt flat. That is expanding rapidly.
So am I. But what may overtake it all is the fire lying underneath. We must face both, salt and fire. Here lies a monster on the verge of waking. My guess is one day soon, everyone will know how to pronounce Uturumku. Uturumku.
The huge mountain they are looking at near the edge of the salt flats is dark around the bottom with a jagged top. When they get back in their vehicles, they leave the road and head out onto the field of salt. It almost looks as though they are driving in midair. The salt is so overwhelmingly white that it is nearly invisible.
This was my goal, to bring you here.
But this is exactly where my colleagues and I were heading. What's the point of all this?
Riley keeps looking ahead. The view turns to move past Laura sitting beside him, to Krause in the front seat, and then past Krause to take in the view through the windshield with nothing but white in every direction until it meets the blue sky. In a bird's eye view, the salt flats are crossed with cracks and ridges running across the whole surface, like a honeycomb pattern seen from above.
I only had an abstract idea how vast this is. Just numbers.
The alarming thing is the speed of its expansion. Almost 800 square miles per year.
If it continues to grow, the salt will cover the entire continent one day.
I'm inclined to think it could cover all landmass on the planet.
Science fiction.
I love to think that way.
You know, speaking of that, this is the ideal landing spot for aliens. Nothing on the planet is so totally flat and so vast. Even our satellites use it to calibrate their distance from the ground.
The view shifts again, and the vehicles are seen speeding over the salt to what looks like an island in a sea of white. The cars approach, resembling science fiction flight pods racing toward a rocky outcrop floating in white space. At the edge of the island, they get out. Krause goes to the other vehicle, and the men start unloading water and supplies. Riley and Laura look at the rock.
So, this is in Kawasi Island.
Put it all down there.
I know it from maps.
I thought the world might see the depth of this place if you experienced something new.
Meaning what? What are they doing over there?
The men jump back in the cars and start to drive away. Laura panics, pounding on the windows as they head off. She sees two small boys left behind as the vehicles depart.
Stop it! Hey! There are children there! Are you mad? Are you crazy? You left children behind!
What am I supposed to do with these kids?
She throws her hat on the ground, then seems to collect herself before approaching the boys. She drops to her knees. The boys do not focus their eyes on her.
Who are you? Do you know why we are here? Who are you? Do you know those men? Riley? Do you know Riley? Have you been here before? You know this place? Huh? Can you see me? Can you see me? Do you understand me? Can you understand me? Huh? Who are you? I am Laura. Laura. And you, what is your name?
Touching her own chest, then the boys.
Laura? Waska. Your name?
Waska. Waska.
Waska? And the other boy. The other boy, is he your brother? Huh? Laura? And what is your name?
Atahualpa.
Atahualpa? Huasca, Laura. Are you brothers? Huasca, Atahualpa, the Royal Inca brothers? Have you been here before? Do you know this island?
She starts to walk, then goes back and takes their hands. They go with her.
Do you know this island?
Looking at the supplies left behind, there are things like a camp stove, a kettle, and several bottles of water. She counts out the bottles, raising the fingers on one of the boy's hands so he can count too.
All the water we have. One.
Oh.
Two.
Fiesta.
Three.
Quince.
Four.
Power.
Five.
Fiesta.
Six.
Sota.
Seven.
Canches.
Eight.
Pusa.
Pusa. Eight.
Pusa.
Come here.
There is a bag of food. She holds up a red onion for him to sniff. He makes a face.
Onion. In your language? Do you like onion?
He shakes his head. She looks around at the desert of salt.
And now? What do we do, huh?
She lifts up a blanket.
We have to build a camp.
She pulls him close. Nearer the supplies, the other brother has found a box of matches. He whispers and shakes them. They unroll a tarp.
Let's do this together.
She guides their hands.
So please help me with this.
Unroll
it. Good. And now unfold. Very good. And one, two, three. Very good.
They manage to raise the tarp on poles.
Give me your hands. Hold this. Hold, okay? Hold still. Good boy.
She encourages them to hold the poles steady.
Good job. Good job. Thank you. I need your help too. Atahualpa, hold it, please. Stay here. Stay here. Stay here, stay here. Don't move, don't move. This is good now. And don't move.
She stretches the tarp and ties it off on a rocky ledge. As she returns to the tarp, one boy lets go to follow her. The tarp stays up.
Good job. Stand still. Good. Now. This is our home now.
Later, on the cracked surface of the salt desert, Huasca stumbles over Laura's bag. Feeling at it, he picks it up by a strap and carries it off toward the shelter. He leaves an object behind on the ground, walking right past it without seeing it. Under the shelter, Laura takes a video recording of the supplies.
All we have is food for about a week. I worry about the water. The salt absorbs all the humidity. We have blankets, toilet paper, kitchen utensils, and a stove.
She powers off the tablet and sits down on a square of folded blanket.
We are trapped here in a vast expanse of salt. No fences, no locked doors. Getting away from the island is impossible. Returning to the shore would mean a 3-day trek across salt.
Later, she and the brothers are trying to set up the camp stove to prepare a meal. She is unable to secure the element onto the propane tank and gives up in frustration. Waska is nearer to her and picks it up. She turns to Atahualpa and has him put his hand into the bag of dry rice to feel it.
Okay, rice.
She pours some into the pot. Holding out a bag of salt to him, he tastes it off her finger.
How do you call it?
Sal.
The stove is assembled.
How about rice? And some of the dried fish? Wow, you did a nice job with the stove. So.
After he is eaten, one of the brothers plays with a magnet held under his dirty metal bowl. A spoon inside slides around, clanking against the bottom, as he moves his hand holding the magnet. Laura watches him, smiling.
Laura?
Yes?
Laura.
He guides her to open her palm.
I'm supposed to hold my hand like this? Wow.
The magnet makes a metal disc flip.
Wow. This is magic. A magnet. Wonderful.
As it gets dark, Laura leaves the boys under the shelter and wanders out onto the salt flats not far from their camp. The sun is going down behind the rocky ridges on their island. The color of the salt has turned from glaring white to gray and looks more like sand in the twilight. They sit side by side under the tarp facing the horizon. Laura sits between the boys. As she sings, the scene shifts from this contemplative moment to show them all asleep together, holding each other's hands. Subtitles. The moon is slowly rising, and on the dark horizon appears the evening star. The wood stands black and silent, and from the meadow climbeth the wispy white fog near and far. The world becomes so quiet. And as the day is dying, so lovely and so dear, a quiet room for sleeping, into oblivion steeping, the day's distress and sober care. As the sun is coming up, Laura and the boys make their way out onto the salt to hike. They all hold hands. A good distance away from the island, they stop. Laura looks in all directions. The boys look at nothing in particular. From the light of daybreak, the salt has a pinkish hue. Small craters in the salt are visible between the cracks. The sky is gradually lightening, the sun already ablaze. At camp, she records her video diary.
Considering the circumstances, the night was good. One of the boys talked in his sleep. Why are we stranded here? Why is Riley doing this to us? How can we hold out?
With a little bit of water, she washes each of their faces by hand and dries them with her scarf. They sit under the tarp in the shade.
Is it good?
Yes. See.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Waska pulls away from her touch but stays in place. She is gentle with him and cleans his face with tenderness.
Like it? Atahualpa? Atahualpa?
Waska.
Come here.
She starts on Atahualpa.
It's good, huh?
Waska squints at the patterns of light made by the sun on metal food cans.
We better save the water for drinking. Hmm?
She kisses Atahualpa's cheek and then holds the cup up for him to drink. She drinks from the same cup. Waska drinks while she holds the cup. They walk along the edge of the island as though it is a shore. As the three of them come around a curve in the rocky shore, it is revealed that the island is home to thousands of towering cactus plants. They rise like a forest from the island's surface. Waska becomes stuck on a cactus.
Atahualpa!
Waska!
Atahualpa,
you stay here, okay?
Hiking back to him.
What are you doing? You should hold your brother's hand. Are you okay? Give me your hand. Okay. Let's go. Good. One step to the right. Big step there.
A bird's eye view of the threesome hiking through the cactus forest shows how small they are in comparison to some of the plants, which are several meters tall. While the brothers sit nearby, Laura uses her binoculars to survey the mountains on the horizon. Seen through the viewfinder, the effect is like a watercolor illustration with layers of dusky blue and gray outlined against a bright blue sky. The salt flats go on, uninterrupted by cars or other people. Later, the boys lie on their sides with their ears pressed against the salt as though they are listening closely. Laura observes this and comes to lie down with them. A tin cup of water is between them. The water in the cup ripples slightly.
Do you hear anything? Something very distant, like a faint grumbling. The salt plain obviously behaves like a gigantic membrane. Are we sitting on a fire that is moving beneath us?
The outline of the volcano is visible on a distant shore. It shows no signs of the turmoil that may be building up beneath the surface. That evening, Laura makes an entry in her video diary.
My wish to have my scientific instruments with me is vanishing. The ocean of salt around me changes my way of seeing things. I find myself in a maze of lines I do not comprehend. It is like an alien planet. This is not of our world.
A close view moving over the surface of the salt shows ridges and cracks with small craters where the salt has collapsed. As the view gets higher, the surface starts to look more like a reptile skin bleached white. Higher still, and it's like a quilt with small lines of stitching all over. The view changes from the endless white of the flats to the inky darkness of the night sky, dotted with brilliant stars. The view slides from the sky to the salt desert, looking like the surface of the moon. Laura lies on her back, gazing up at the sky. Slowly, she closes her eyes.
I wish the boys could see what I see. If I stretched out my hands, I could harvest the stars.
The next day, they play a board game with dice and a cup.
Good.
Atahualpa examines the dice closely.
Laura.
Wow. Six.
She hands him the dice to feel.
Feel. Six. Three, four, five, six. Waska.
He shakes the dice vigorously and dumps it out.
Wow.
Six.
Feel it.
They continue to play, rolling the dice and moving pegs along the square wooden board. The moves do not always match the number rolled.
Did you cheat? Yeah? You go back with this, huh? Four. 1, 2, 3, 4. Waska.
On the board are four corner squares painted red, green, yellow, and blue. They move the pegs between them on pathways.
Oh, it's okay.
Oh. Waska, what did you do?
See.
Like cheating, huh? You like cheating.
See.
She tickles Waska.
Oh, it's guy in the tower.
Tower.
Oh,
congratulations.
Laura.
Laura grabs them both and the game dissolves into a tickle fest.
You are two cheaters. I saw that you were cheating on me. Is that true? Did you cheat on Laura? All the time you were cheating on Laura, huh? You were cheating on me.
Laura squints out at a shape on the horizon, but it is just a cloud. The sun going down turns the sky amber. The silhouette of the mountain in front of it is as flat as black paper. To her tablet.
I can't believe it is already Tuesday. Time makes no sense anymore. Here I am, stranded with two blind boys.
Her voice is heard over an extended montage of images showing the boys brushing her hair. They seem fascinated with the texture, the way it moves, and the feel of the hairbrush bristles.
My former life has almost completely disappeared. I feel that I'm changing, but how, I do not know.
She sits very still while the boys brush her hair and feel her face. Almost expressionless, she does not seem bothered by the exploration of their small fingers or the mess they make of her hair. She keeps her eyes on the horizon. Feeling his way through the empty water bottles and tossing them away, one of the boys finds a bottle partly full. He seems pleased, but just leaves it. Later, Laura looks through her binoculars.
What if nobody comes to our rescue? What do I tell the boys when we run out of water? They are totally unaware of the impending danger.
Meanwhile, the boys are playing with colorful Lego blocks on the salt. They are building and pretending, seemingly oblivious to their surroundings. Each has a separate project they are working on. They feel each piece and hold some up close to their eyes. Sometimes their eyes focus, but more often their eyes roll up or to the side. Their faces are a study in concentration and determination, however. In the harsh light of the sun, their clothes are grimy and salt-stained, but the Legos are like new. As the view expands, they seem very small and dark against the endless white salt. At camp, they are playing, and one kicks over a water bottle.
What are you doing? There's such little water left. Hey, what did you do, huh? Hey.
She stops herself.
I'm sorry. Sorry, boys. I'm sorry.
She holds them both close. At twilight, she watches the horizon again. Her face is utterly expressionless. The air is still. Nothing moves. the screen goes dark. The next day, the boys stop and listen.
Laura, escucha.
I hear nothing.
She puts on her sunglasses. In the distance, the vehicles seem as small as the Lego toys. They get bigger as they approach. The vehicles stop and Riley gets out. He opens his arms.
Los niños, here I am. Here I am. Come on, boys. Well,
Papa. Hola, Papa.
I'm scared. Hey.
Papa.
Oh, oh.
He lifts the boys into his arms, holding them close.
Oh. Oh. Come closer. You are part of the family now, so to speak.
Are you kidding? Are you kidding me?
Armed men roll Kraus out of the van in his wheelchair. He wears mirrored sunglasses with lines on the lenses. He stands.
Good to see you again, Dr. Sommerfeld.
Nice to see you again, Kraus. I want an explanation.
Accepted.
And an apology.
I will not apologize.
I deserve an apology.
You are with a man who is accepting he is going to prison.
How are my companions you have so kindly kidnapped and poisoned?
They are in excellent shape. Professor.
Thank God.
Well, there is one grave concern with Dr. Cavani. He has grown slightly pale and needs to be sent to a tanning salon. These boys, they are my sons. The mother died shortly after she gave birth to the younger one, Atahualpa. She died because of the toxicity of the environment around the town.
She was a local woman from Colchani.
These boys are mine now. I adopted them after their mother died. And in 3 years, they will be completely blind. Blind children have no stake in any regime.
What does it have to do with my report on Diablo Blanco?
This disaster is man-made.
Of course it is.
No. Let me speak. You see, I am the CEO of the consortium which is responsible for all this. The toxins, the desiccation of the lake, the transformation of a whole landscape into salt. The failure of a glorious irrigation system which diverted two large rivers, both of which are now beyond repair. And the salt here is expanding. There were fish here. A few decades ago, boats, fishermen. Hard to imagine, isn't it?
But I was prepared to report on this. Why did you take me hostage?
I wanted to report back to the United Nations that contained something more than scientific data, graphs, and lifeless statistics. A report with something different in it. A report of a lake so poisonous that two boys who grew up near its shores became blind. They will never see a world like this again.
Her look softens. She takes a step toward him, but hesitates. He steps back, shaking his head, and takes a breath.
And now, before I turn myself into the authorities, please allow me two things. And this is number one. Number one. Laura, can I call you by your first name?
Of course.
Please bring me your tablet, a toy, and a spoon.
My tablet? A toy and a spoon?
Yes.
Okay.
He sets up a photo.
Okay, Laura, take a step to the left. Tiny. Right, good. Okay, hold your arms up. Okay, now elbows to hips.
Like that?
Right, and your hands flat, like this. Okay.
Using forced perspective, it looks like a tiny boy stands on each of her hands. Now, Kraus.
Okay, crouch down. Crouch down. Okay, now hold still.
In this picture, Laura sits on a spoon as Riley eats.
Laura, a little bit to the left. That's good. Okay. Put your back foot up. Ah, that's good. Okay, scream!
Using a toy, they look like they are running from a giant lizard.
These photos will keep me company in prison. That's why I wanted them, you see. And here is the second thing I wanted to do.
An airline ticket.
It's for me?
Yes.
A ticket to Rome? First class?
Have you forgotten Santissima Trinita?
The saint under the tree?
Right.
She looks at him searchingly and steps closer. They do not touch, but stand face to face.
But what if you do not turn yourself in?
I'll be caught anyway.
Then go on the run to Rome. I guess that's where I am going to be.
I don't know what to say.
Why are you standing here? Book yourself a ticket.
Kraus rides up with champagne.
Guys, I have a premonition about this. We have to celebrate with champagne. All that's missing are alien astronauts from a faraway galaxy, traveling for centuries through the eternal darkness of space. They see this white heaven below, and they descend in their spacecraft with flickering lights in a cloud of salt.
Wonderful. But how do we attract them? We need some kind of satellite transmission.
Nonsense. The champagne will be the bait.
He gets up and sets the oversized bottle on the seat of the wheelchair. He flicks the control to on, and the wheelchair drives off with no one on board, over the salt, toward the horizon. The elongated shadow of the wheelchair passes over the boys as they play on the salt. The chair keeps going as the view expands. The wheelchair gets smaller and smaller until it almost disappears. The screen goes dark. Credits. Starring Veronica Ferres as Dr. Laura Summerfield, Michael Shannon as Matt Riley, Gail Garcia Bernal as Dr. Fabio Cavani, Volker Michalowski as Dr. Arnold Meyer, with Lawrence Krauss as Krauss Aristides, Anita Bream as the flight attendant, Danner Ignacio Marquez Arancibia as Waska, Gabriel Marquez Arancibia as Atahualpa, Produced by Michael Benaroya, Pablo Cruz, Werner Herzog, and Nina Meg. With executive producers Wayne Mark Godfrey, Robert Jones, Gregory McLaughlin, Ben Sachs, and Arturo Sampson. Adapted from a short story by Tom Bissell. Written by Werner Herzog. Directed by Werner Herzog. A Construction Film production, Skellig Rock production. In co-production with Benaroya Pictures, Kanana Films, ZDF, ARTE, Potemkin. With support from FFF Bayern. Copyright 2016.